Thank you all so much for joining us. As Pamela mentioned up top, we are in the second Sunday of Advent season. So in case you don't know, that's Christians all over the world have a shared calendar this time of year where there's a series of reflections and events and remembrances leading up to Christmas Day. That's the celebrating Jesus's birth. So it's a common Advent tradition to do what we did, which was you light a candle on each of the four Sundays leading up to Advent. And there's a theme associated with each of those candles that we at Spark here have been going through along with many Christians all over the world. So last week, our theme was hope. This week, our theme is peace. And Pamela actually mentioned the Prince of Peace in particular coming up to this. So that is, Prince of Peace is interesting. It is a common phrase or title ascribed to Jesus, but especially around Christmas time. That's all the more interesting to me because the Bible itself never ascribes that title to Jesus. Among the many titles that it does directly attribute to Jesus, it doesn't call him Prince of Peace. It's more of a king of peace, if anything, as it were. You know, prince seems like a demotion once you have that kind of perspective on it. But I actually do think that a lot of the popularity around using the title Prince of Peace in particular around Christmas time is because of the baby Jesus in particular, right? It's to think of Jesus as a prince who will like one day grow up to be king, right? So look at that beautiful little cute Prince of Peace. I don't know if that's cute. This is like standard Jesus art, baby Jesus artwork for centuries in many places in Europe. I guess baby Jesus, there's on a trajectory for the greatest glow up of all time, becoming an adult. So notice how I did not show you pictures of hot adult Jesus, because last time I did, y'all got distracted for minutes. So we're not, this is what you get instead. But I think this title is actually worth spending some focused time on this Advent season. This particular title occurs actually in Isaiah. And it's in a section that famously also includes another passage that we routinely connect to Christmas. It's in this broader section that talks about the virgin birth, or at least Christians use that that passage to talk about the virgin birth. So it's all the more reason I think that we should, we tend to tie these things together. I think it's worth talking through them as a whole. So we'll work through all of these connections, but first let's actually like read through this text in Isaiah, okay? So it's in Isaiah 9 that sets this up, and we'll give more context in a bit, but let's just first read it. So it starts with, "Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who were in distress." Then a little bit it says, "In the future, God will honor Galilee of the nations by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan." And then it goes into a poem. "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever." So this is the kind of passage that many of us will unmistakably attribute to Jesus. We can't not see Jesus in this kind of passage. In fact, I think a lot of it, again, I think it's reinforced by like many of the songs and reflections that we've had over the centuries. In fact, I'm curious, as I was reading through this, was anyone tempted to sing along to it in any ways, perhaps because of Handel's Messiah? See, this our vintage Christians are familiar with that particular song. Christians have been singing it for centuries, in English, like the English version of it. It's actually from Handel's Messiah, right? And so I think many people, have been singing it for a long time. And in Handel's Messiah in particular, this is like one of the climactic moments, like this landing of this Prince of Peace message. We've talked about many times here at Spark how we can have a tendency that, when we come across passages like this, because we see Jesus in it so much, we can't even think about what this passage would have meant in its original context to its original audience. And when that happens, I would actually argue that we lose something about not only what God was saying through Isaiah at that time, but about what we can know through Jesus through that passage as well. So we actually should level set just a little bit, because we're going to spend some time like trying to unpack different dimensions of Isaiah here. It's helpful to think through, like, you know, just the overall context of Isaiah. So one is, one of the top Old Testament books that Jesus quotes from is Isaiah. So he actually gets a lot of his own understanding who he is and what he's about from that book. The way in which he and other New Testament writers use it have caused many scholars over the years to actually, they dub Isaiah the fifth gospel, like because of the role that it plays in helping people, understand Jesus's connection to the Old Testament. Like I mentioned too, Handel's Messiah heavily utilizes it as well. But to think about this text in its original context, it was written covering a period of 700 to 500 years before Jesus. Isaiah was a prophetic voice to Israel while Israel was facing destruction from the Assyrian and Babylonian empires at the time. And the whole book is 66 chapters long. So it's one of the heftier books of the Old Testament. And it has messages of warning and judgment and hope interweaved throughout the whole thing, all 66 chapters. And basically, you can think of the book in two parts. The first part is like the first two-thirds of the book. It's before Israel goes into Babylonian exile. So there are a lot of warnings or judgments or assessments of why Israel is about to go into exile, what is going to happen. It's like a scathing critique of Israel's complicity in the oppression of the kingdoms surrounding them. And then there are, of course, like messages of hope and restoration woven into that. And then the last third, the second part, is actually written from the perspective of after Babylonian exile. So it's actually written from the perspective of having had time to reflect on going into exile and then thinking about God's role in truly restoring Israel and the bigger restoration of all things, restoration of the whole world that comes with that. So it's obvious from the outset of the book that Israel is under dire threat, whether Israel is willing to admit it or not, because part of the role of the prophet is they see things in a way that the rest of the community does not see it, and it is their job to tell that truth. And so a big question on the minds of that audience would be, how bad is it going to get, and how long is it going to take? So that's where the first question, like around peace, like that this audience would be concerned with is when? When, like, you know, with destruction on the horizon, when can we expect restoration or relief from this this persecution? So that's what we'll talk about first. And in this, like, there's actually a discussion in the early chapters of Isaiah that are directly about this idea of when, like what the time horizon for something like this is. So there is, in Isaiah 7, there's, I think many of you will recognize, there's the famous line, "Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Look, the young woman is with child and shall bear a son and shall name him Emmanuel." Okay? So again, I know you look at this and you're like, right, that's about Jesus 700 years in advance. But I think, again, we should talk through the really the mess of the situation that caused this line to be written in the first place. So so as context on the background for this line first, the king of Syria and the king of northern Israel. So at this time, Israel is basically in two kingdoms. There's a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom called Judah. So Syria and the northern kingdom have formed an alliance to resist the kingdom of Assyria, not to be confused with the kingdom of Syria. So Assyria is, in the 700 BC era, the big empire, the big oppressive empire over all of these. So the king of Assyria, king of northern Israel, they have formed an alliance to try to protect themselves from the kingdom of Assyria. And they tried to pressure King Ahaz, that's the king of Judah, of southern Israel, into joining their alliance, which would mean that King Ahaz would be subsumed under their, like, under their authority. So he refuses to join that alliance, and then Syria and the northern kingdom of Israel actually clarified that that was an offer that he was not allowed to refuse. He wasn't allowed to refuse, so they actually threatened to invade Judah. And so there you find Ahaz in this situation where, instead of trusting God, that God would protect Judah, he actually considers forming an alliance with Assyria so that he can maintain independence from Syria and the northern kingdom of Israel. And can you imagine that mess? Like, this is where all that, like, you know, Israel, in terms of trying to be set apart from the corruption and coercive systems around them, this is like standard normal politics. Like, that's what it has come to in that situation. So as King Ahaz is contemplating this, Isaiah confronts Ahaz, asking him to rely on God versus the corrupt political powers of the day, and to reassure Ahaz that it'll be okay, that God will in fact protect Judah. He says, I'll give you a sign. I'll give you a sign that everything will be okay. And that's where this passage comes from. So the sign is, look, a young woman is born, or a young woman will bear a child, and that son will be called Emmanuel. And then there's a little more context after that that Pastor Tom actually alluded to last week, where the part of the promise is, you know, before that child like grows up basically to be an adult, before that time passes, this threat will pass. So in that, you know, in that context, that is where this promise lands. So, you know, whatever we think that it could mean about Jesus, you first have to reckon with the reality that in that time horizon for that day, it was talking about something that should, it's the opposite of like being fulfilled in 700 years, something that would be fulfilled in years, like, you know, you could count on your hand kind of years on their immediate horizon. And this is where then, so like, you know, with that context in mind, then I think we can look more healthily at the way Matthew uses it in our famous Christmas passage that we always think about, right? So where Matthew said, all this took place. Now Matthew is talking about the virginal conception of baby Jesus by Mary. And he says, all this took place to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet. Look, the virgin shall become pregnant and give birth to a son, and they shall name him Emmanuel, which means God with us. So one thing too, I think we should do a bit of an aside to talk through a topic that comes up when we like look at these passages together about what's going on with young woman versus virgin. So maybe you noticed that, right? So in the passage in Isaiah, it says, look, the young woman is with child and shall bear a son. And then by the time it gets to Matthew, it says the virgin shall become pregnant and give birth to a son. Now, if you read that and you're like, yeah, that's fine. I don't have any concerns with it. That's great. Good for you. I think you're doing it right. But for whatever reason, that distinction can trip a lot of people up, both Christians and non-Christians, about what's actually going on. How is this a prediction about baby Jesus? And how do New Testament writers use the Old Testament? So maybe you've even heard the critique. Like, it's common among many people, even including some scholars, to say, oh, well, the virgin birth then was just based on a mistranslation. That's the idea. It's like, oh, used to say young woman, somewhere along the line, someone translated to virgin, and then, you know, bam, we've got Mary, like we have a legend about Mary being a virgin when Jesus was born. So they have these kinds of debates. And I think one thing that I just wanted to provide for you is that I would say that to call it to say that the virgin birth is based on a mistranslation, I think is that's not the right way to frame it overall. Just to think about how this works. So it is true that in the Hebrew text of Isaiah, the word there for in Hebrew is young woman. Now, in that context, back then, it meant like a young unmarried woman. So it's very likely, practically speaking, that that also meant that that woman was a virgin. In fact, sometimes that word is used interchangeably to describe either one. And it's also true that by the time you get to the Greek translation, this would have been centuries after the Hebrew text, in the Greek translation, they chose a specific word that really does mean virgin and not just like young woman in general. There's a lot of reasons that to wonder like why they might have done that. But either way, by the time you get to Matthew, you have him saying he clearly picks virgin to describe it. Now, it's common in apologetic circles to try to downplay the fact that along the line through all of those texts, interpreters made some creative choices along the way. It's also uncharitable to say that it was based on a mistake, as if Matthew didn't know what he was doing. I think what's helpful to really think about is that someone like Matthew is actually starting from their experience and their community's experience with the birth of Jesus, and they're looking backwards into the Old Testament text to find meaning and imagery that really speaks to them in that particular context. I actually think that it's very reasonable to think that Matthew was aware of the Hebrew or Greek translation. I think he chose the Greek translation because it suited the story that he was trying to tell in that moment. Something, an aside that I think is helpful to keep in mind. It also just to speak to the flexibility with how New Testament writers like Matthew say something from the Old Testament was fulfilled in Jesus is apparent in this passage itself, where it says that that you're going to name him Jesus. That's what the text in Matthew says. And of course, the prophecy says you'll name him Emmanuel. So clearly, even Matthew doesn't care about lining that detail up correctly. Because we understand, let's go, yeah, it's flexible. You can have two names. These things can mean many things, right? The idea is that you got to work from the point that Matthew is trying to make and work backwards from there. We do this all the time. You actually, if the same people who are very interested in apologetics and get nervous about thinking about Old Testament prophecy flexibly, I think get tripped up when not even every passage from Isaiah that is about the Messiah gets, can be reasonably connected to Jesus. So for example, do you remember that one of the messianic passages about Jesus is he had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. But of course, you all know that Jesus was a very handsome grown-up, so that couldn't possibly, he didn't fulfill that. Although maybe that's actually the historically more accurate picture of what Jesus looked like. That would be an interesting plot twist, right? Yeah, I mean, that's enough. I can't look at that more. I think the key here is that I actually think that it is helpful to embrace a Matthean outlook wherever you see peace and wherever you see peace like being forged, then you see Jesus in it and around it and working through it retroactively, right? You can look at the world in a way where you can reorient parts of the story God is telling around what you see in Jesus. So the second part that I think is also especially on the minds of the audience in Isaiah, and it's actually probably the harder question. So it's not a matter of when. I think that a lot of Isaiah's audience would have been prepared to wait for a certain amount of time, and they were trained in patience for God to fulfill God's promises. I actually think what is much more jarring in the story of Isaiah and what comes through in our understanding of Jesus as Prince of Peace is how it is that Jesus actually accomplishes peace and how Isaiah creates some threads that Jesus follows through on. So I'll give you an example of what I mean. When the book of Isaiah as a whole has these different reflections for how it is that God will restore Israel, there's a couple different threads, sometimes threads that seem fundamentally opposed to each other. One major thread is this idea that someday when God does restore Israel, God will do it through a Davidic king. So that's like in the passage that we just read in Isaiah earlier. And so, you know, an example of this, even in like Isaiah 52, which is close to those other passages that we frequently attribute to Jesus' suffering, would be how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of the messenger who announces peace, who brings good news, who announces salvation, who says to Zion, your God reigns. So again, I think and even the Isaiah's original audience would have been like, yes, one day the hero that is going to lead us into full restoration will be a king like David. They will be powerful. They will be venerated. They will be respected by their enemies. There's a second thread that occurs in Isaiah that a lot of interpreters before Jesus' time would have treated distinctly. And so that is this thread of a suffering servant. So, okay, so at the same time that you have this idea of a Davidic king being the force through whom God will restore Israel, in the book of Isaiah, you also have this figure, this suffering servant, who in this odd, mysterious, ironic way is the righteous embodiment of all of Israel's hopes and dreams. And they suffer greatly at the hands of their enemies for it. And the way Isaiah talks about it is that in a profound way, Israel experiences atonement through that person, because that person in their righteousness gets persecuted and is ultimately destroyed for taking on a punishment that they didn't deserve, that the rest of Israel did. So these were two different images woven within Isaiah, mixed in between. What was unique about Jesus's understanding of Isaiah, the way he corralled that message to point to his ministry, again, for you, in retrospect, it's probably obvious. For his contemporaries in his time, this is what was revolutionary, was Jesus was making the claim that that Davidic king, that glorious, honorable, powerful person, and the suffering servant were in fact the same person. And he was saying that person was him. Now you, again, after centuries of living in a Christian context, probably having been exposed to, maybe your first understanding of who God is came from understanding who Jesus is, you may take for granted how shocking or jarring it is to argue that all of these, these different diametrically opposed aspects of God redeeming Israel could all be found in one person. I actually, grew up as a Muslim. I became a Christian when I was in high school. I remember that one of the reflections I had as an outsider, something that I thought was unique about Christianity, was that their conception of God seems, for Christians, your Christian's conception of God really does seem to hinge around a God who dies and a God who suffers. And if you come from a culture where, it's all about respecting authority figures. It is very, it's jarring, it's embarrassing, it's almost beneath the idea, it's an idea that it's beneath a messenger of God to suffer in that way. I'll give you just an example of how the very high bar that in my life as a child that we had for how much respect and authority and veneration any heroic or kingly figure in the Bible deserved. So some of you may remember there was a PBS kids show in the 90s called Wishbone. So there's adventures that this dog got into, but there's a story within the story for every episode where the dog would act out classic literature stories. There was one episode where they did David and Goliath. Okay. And so Wishbone, the dog, played the role of King David. Now, again, so there are many cultures like this too, still today, Jewish, Muslim, and Christian cultures, especially, for example, it may be in the Middle East, where it is fundamentally disrespectful to portray heroic figures of the Bible in these kinds of ways. Like, I remember watching this at the time the episode aired, and I had one of those moments that kids do, like, I don't want my parents to come in and see this, because they'll be really upset. And I have a memory. My mom came in, she saw us watching it, and I was like, I know she's going to say it. She's like, are they having a dog play King David? Like, that was extremely offensive, right? But when you have that level of respect for those kinds of figures in the Bible. And I remember a big sticking point for me before I became a Christian was like, it seems hard to respect a God, an all-powerful God who lets themselves do the things that Jesus does in the Bible on behalf of his enemies, and to still somehow call that person God or divine in some way, right? This was a challenging point for many early Christian communities as well to grapple with. But, like many people, once I became more familiar with what Jesus's sacrifice with his power was able to accomplish, then it was easier for me to work from that premise, work backwards from there, and rework my conception of God around that sacrifice. Many philosophers in the centuries before Jesus and after Jesus have really honed in on this type of question that, for example, often gets attributed to Plato, where the measure of a person is what they do with power. And I think that I personally have never been more awe of or humbled by Jesus's response to that type of statement. I have found that in my life to be unique among people in history that we could choose to venerate. And Jesus made it very clear that he was at war with all of the dark, oppressive powers that existed in this day. But he also made it, at the same time, painfully clear that the path to peace costs all the power that we have. Several writers in the New Testament, once they have had time to reflect on Jesus and his sacrifice, and they've had some time to rework their conception of God, really flesh this out well. So, for example, the Apostle Paul in Philippians says, "Let each of you look not to your own interests, but to the interests of others. Let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who," and then here's his own poem in the flow of Isaiah's poems, "who, though he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, assuming human likeness, and being found in appearance as a human, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross. Therefore, God exalted him even more highly and gave him the name that is above every name, so that at the name given to Jesus, every knee should bend in heaven and on earth and under earth, and every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father." Similar reflection that he offers that specifically ties together the themes that we're talking about today, where Paul in Colossians says, "For God was pleased to have all God's fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross." And I think a last one that a reflection that the Apostle Paul offers, this is one that explicitly ties in some of the hopes and themes that Isaiah mentions, where Paul says, "The last enemy to be destroyed is death," in 1 Corinthians. And then he finishes the thought by saying, "And then the saying that is written will be fulfilled." And he quotes Isaiah and Hosea. He says, "Death has been swallowed up in victory. Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting?" This is something that the original audience with Isaiah, I don't think, could have possibly grasped the full appreciation of it. Something that even in Jesus's day, the people who lived with him could not have grasped. It's one of those things that, again, lean into your experience with the risen Jesus and let that work into how you interpret the story. One final reflection that I have that I think can really bring home the point that, you know, we're going with for the Prince of Peace is, you know, I often point out how it wasn't obvious to anybody in Jesus's day. You would think that that would mean that Jesus would be very forgiving when people seemed to miss the point of what he was saying. And then recently, the kids and we were reading through the Gospel of Luke, and we got to the end. And there is a line towards the end of the Gospel where Jesus, after he is risen, he's in disguise. People can't recognize him. He's walking with two guys down the road to Emmaus just days after the news about his crucifixion. He says to these two men, Jesus said to them, "You foolish people, you find it so hard to believe all that the prophets wrote in the scriptures. Wasn't it clearly predicted that the Messiah would have to suffer all these things before entering his glory?" So I like that the New Living Translation in particular sounds extra judgy, which is like, wait a second, Pastor Omer, I thought this whole time you were saying that this stuff is hard to predict or to foresee in advance. And that is true. Like it's clear in essence, people miss the point. But I also think, like, reading this passage, I was convicted to actually realize that, you know, not everybody missed the point. It wasn't impossible to see for everyone. And that's the part that I think can be especially meaningful for us to think through. We at Spark, through many guest speakers at various times, have talked about this idea called the epistemological advantage of the marginalized. Dense phrase. The idea is epistemological means like how we know things. And this idea is that people who are marginalized have a unique advantage in knowing things precisely because they are marginalized. And when you go with that idea through the Gospels and you see who did get the message and who didn't, you see this type of principle lived out. The concept that, I think it's clear that, so like many of the same people that Sparkers connect with today on a regular basis in all kinds of work and the ways that you live your lives today, like with prisoners or the people who are unhoused, the sexually marginalized children, people on the margins in all kinds of ways, those people are the same people who stuck with Jesus the whole way in Jesus's ministry. And when we connect with those people today and we read the gospel with one hand and connect with people in the other, we see Jesus showing us that we must listen to them because they see the truth in a way that we can't. You know, there are like related ideas that catch the flip side of this too. You know how like we have the phrase, to the hammer, every problem is a nail. This is a similar idea you really could extend to that, to the powerful, exercising power really is the main way that they understand like how to solve problems. I am guilty of doing this as a parent. This happens. This is how the business world works. This is how governments work. It is why even someone like King George III, a historical figure who wants to share peace and love with the American colonies, used the only force that he had in his poem, because when push comes to shove, I will kill your friends and family to remind you of my love, right? That's the idea. When you're powerful, that's just all you got. That's your first thought on how to solve things. But it's those without power who see the world for what it really is. Power is self-protecting. It's self-deluding. It's those without power who can actually see true paths to peace that the rest of us can't. If you've recently seen Wicked, or if you haven't yet, you should. It's a fun time. But I've seen this narrative play out in there as well. It's not a coincidence within that story that Elphaba, And Dr. Dilliman, he's the goat-like figure on the right. He's a professor. It's not a coincidence that these two characters, who are both systematically marginalized in the world of Oz, are the only ones to understand the truth about like all of the propaganda and layering that occurs in that land. It's interesting too, like in the musical itself, the word that Elphaba uses to describe, or that both of the characters use to describe how they see things, is like they're aware that they see the world differently. That's the key phrase that they use, different. They have a different perspective. But I remember thinking like, no, it's not just that they see the world differently. They see it accurately. That is the point about the epistemological advantage of the marginalized. It's not just like, oh, isn't it great to have different perspectives? No. It is saying that those on the margins really do see the truth better than we do. It's also not a coincidence then that in the Gospels, it's the women who are with Jesus at every step of the way in his ministry, from birth to death, to burial, to resurrection. It's not a coincidence that Luke contrasts these women with the men on the road to Emmaus, right? So the two men on the road to Emmaus are two dudes talking with each other for hours about something it turns out they actually know nothing about and deserve judgment for their ignorance. That is, as historians say, the original podcast. This is the challenge, right? There are these two guys who are like this. And you could read that story and be like, oh, isn't it so hard? Isn't it so hard to see what Jesus is doing and ignore the fact that so many people in Jesus' life saw what he was doing all along? It's those on the outside, those acquainted with pain and suffering, those are who are on the outer rim of society, but in God's inner circle, they get it. They know how the world treats God's messengers, but they choose to be God's messengers anyway. Now, did they understand all the contours in which all of these passages in their scriptures were fulfilled in Jesus? Of course not. They didn't. But they understood enough to want to be where Jesus was, whether in the manger, as our Christmas stories say, whether at his burial, whether at the empty tomb. They wanted to be there in those places when all of those of us with power didn't. So I think a reflection here offered too is that we should listen to them, believe them, those who are on the margins, and let them show us the way to the Prince of Peace. Now we're doing our time together, as always, where we reflect especially on Jesus' sacrifice and its ability to free us from the sin and oppression that has plagued all of us, our ancestors in the faith, God's people throughout all time. And we do this in the tradition that was handed down to us from Jesus himself, where it says, "For in the night in which he was betrayed, our Lord Jesus took the bread, blessed and broke it, giving it to his disciples, saying, 'Take, eat, this is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' Likewise, after supper, he took the cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, 'Drink this, all of you. This is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for you and for many for the forgiveness of sins. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me.'"